Welcome to this edition of What's the Score? Let me remind you, if you enjoyed today's podcast, please click the like button wherever you listen to this program. And if you'd like to support this and future programs, I encourage you to become a patron via patreon.com. There'll be details to follow in the middle of the program. We couldn't do the program without our patrons, so thank you. And enjoy today's wonderful podcast.
Today's program made possible by patrons like you.
Welcome to where we celebrate music from the movies. From the golden age to present day, we've got it all covered. We talk to those in the entertainment industry and find out about their favorite scores. You found the podcast, What's the Score? I'm your host, Frank R. Wilson. So sit back, relax, grab a popcorn, and let's see what we'll be hearing today. Recognize that music? It's a favorite of our guest today. He hails from Argentina, which influences his film scores. His award-winning work can be heard in diverse works, such as a concert to unveil two Omega watches, to documentaries such as The Sound of Identity, and feature films like The Reunion. Upcoming projects include the feature film Empire Queen, The Golden Age of Magic. His awards are quite frankly too numerous to mention, so let's just get on with it, and please join me in welcoming Nicholas Repetto to the program. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate you joining us. You've had a real interesting career so far, and interested in trying to explore that as we go further. So, as all my listeners know, I always like to find out a little bit more about the person behind the baton, I guess, if you will. And so, if you wouldn't mind, maybe tell me a little bit about yourself, growing up, family, you know, those sorts of things, your formative years, I guess you might say.
Of course, yeah. I actually grew up in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and in a small town, actually 3 hours south of Buenos Aires, called Tandil. Very rural, lot of green, a lot of cows, a lot of horses.
So I've been to Argentina, and I know what you're talking about. So, yeah, absolutely beautiful country. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No worries. And a lot of gauchos, so the guys who ride the horses. It's basically like a South American cowboy. So I grew up around that. I was born in 1979. So this is after, because Argentina had this not a very good 10-year decade before that. In the 70s, it was a big military dictatorship. Okay. So I grew up after that, and it was still in the midst of like things calming down. So I think my parents decided when I was five, it was time to go. So they looked at each other. You know, my brother was also 1 year old at the time, and we hightailed it out of there and moved to Miami, Florida. So at five. We moved to Miami. This is like 1985, I think, or 84. So moved to Miami during the Reagan years, very welcoming, and, you know, immigrants come in and join us. We moved to Miami Beach, actually. So I lived getting used to everything was interesting because I was, you know, at five, you're used to a certain thing. Although it's still formative years.
Right.
Where I think they put me in this magnet program for English immersion. So my Argentine accent was eliminated immediately. I had a very thick accent. So I remember going home with like these cassette tapes of like English and grammar and stuff like that. So I mean, it was very good. I learned, went to public school there. Fisher Feinberg Elementary. And that is when I started kind of like learning about music, and they had music classes in there. So at a very early age, I took choir and we played recorder and just had a fun time. We had a music teacher who was amazing. I still remember her name, Miss Love.
Oh, wow.
She had a beautiful name. And she literally, like, we played music games. She would, like, draw on the ground just with chalk, like, the music staff, and then we would, like, jump around. Okay, name the notes in the spaces, name the notes on the lines, and we would jump around. And I really remember that because I had a good time, and she made music so much just enchanting and joyful. And she conducted the choir, and it was fantastic. So,
you know, your story is very inspiring. I don't know if people these days, because it's obviously a lot in the news and those sorts of things about people wanting to come here, how difficult that journey must have been, not speaking the language and, you know, trying to escape an area that was, you know, well, I don't know how to describe it, but I mean, you were trying, you know, basically you were trying to escape, is what I gather from you, and taking that gigantic leap to move to a strange place where you couldn't speak the language, you didn't know the culture. I mean, how did you get through that? My hat's off to you. I don't know how you did that. I mean, tell me a little bit about what that journey was like.
Yeah, it was, during that time of the dictatorship, there were a lot of people disappearing. So, you know, my parents, I have to, you know, give it, looking back and reflecting on this, I think my parents had a lot of courage just to pick up and move. And luckily my dad, he had a good business deal here that allowed us to move with some income and stuff like this. So
yeah,
he had the forethought to do that. Because most people just, you know, just have to leave without these kinds of resources. So, but it was very challenging my parents didn't know a word of English. They had to, find work, because we were on temporary visas and stuff like this. So find work, any way they could, cleaning houses. You know, my dad also started a recycling business, in Miami Beach, which is successful for a time with working with the school system. So it was like the first of its kind. I think I get my resourcefulness from him. He was just a go-getter, and just instilled that in me, even though I was like completely the opposite. I was like super shy. I hated talking to people. He would force me to talk to everybody. He's like, go talk to that guy. We need something for the business. Can you go, like, you know, English, go talk. So I was the forced translator.
I'm curious now, like a lot of people, did by any chance, did you end up using like television or films to try and help your English or learn your English?
I think so. I think it reinforced. I mean, I used to watch a lot of Saturday morning cartoons and a lot of movies. Oh my gosh, yes, so many movies. I think this is why also my love of film music came from. It's just, even though I didn't know it at the time, I think it was kind of seeping into my psyche. I'm like, there's something about not only the English, obviously, and learning that, but just the music as well. But
yeah,
definitely the movies have helped, and just television in general.
Well, and we'll get into that in a moment, which kind of actually segues nicely to one of the cues that we wanted to play today. One of the things that I asked you to do, as my listeners well know, is we want to know what influences are out there for your work, and you had chosen several different cues that you wanted to play today and share with our audience. Now, the first one I thought I would play is by one of my favorite composers. That's Jerry Goldsmith. The cue you chose was from the film King Solomon's Mines. I believe the cue is called Quatermain's March. Tell me a little bit about why you wanted to choose that and share it with our audience today.
So, I could have picked Star Trek, you know, Alien. Jerry Goldsmith's The Mummy. He's done so many. His breadth of work is insane.
Oh, yeah.
He was just a genius. So I picked something because when I was a kid, I was watching all these movies. I would go to the video store down the street, rent them. And I think I rented either King Solomon's Mines or Alan Quatermain and the Lost City of Gold.
Right.
It was these versions created by the H. Rider Haggard novels from the Victorian times. And they were like kind of tongue in cheek and kind of silly with Richard Chamberlain and Sharon Stone. But I thought what stood out to me was the music. So this particular march, I would always like just, I don't know, it would make me want to like put an adventurer's hat and go on an expedition. It's that good. I mean, that's, yeah, it's thrilling. So yeah, this is why I chose it.
Okay, well, let's have a listen for ourselves. Again, it's from the film King Solomon's Mines. It's called Quatermain's March, and it's written by the maestro, Jerry Goldsmith. You've kind of alluded to it, and so let's explore this a little bit. It's hard for me to, I'm trying to figure out how to ask this in an intelligent way. What was it that drew you to music that you would witness in TV shows and films? Was there, I mean, it obviously made an impression on you. So, I mean, just talk to me a little bit about what was it that drew your interest, I guess, in you were interested in music already, but what was it about film music that really interested you a bit?
I think for me, it was just watching the picture and then hearing this either rousing, very moving melody that did something to my inner workings of my brain, or, you know, my just in the, on the psychological level, that moved me. And I can tell you the exact moment when that happened, where I'm like, I want to pursue, for instance, film scoring as a career.
Oh, please do share it. Yeah.
It was actually two moments, and one led to another. It was back in college. This is around the year 1999, 2000. I watched The House of Sand and Fog, and it was scored by James Horner.
Okay.
A super dramatic movie. You know, it's a tragedy, basically. And just the score there was incredibly uplifting. And I was, at that time, dabbling in composition. So it, because I went to college because I wanted to be a violinist, and I was going to, you know, get an audition, play in an orchestra, and just do that.
Yeah.
And then I started taking composition classes through, you know, kind of general exploratory stuff. And then that led to movie kind of film composition, music composition. And that movie, then later, Lord of the Rings, watching the first one from, I think it came out in 2001, watching that against the theater, not knowing what it was, because I've never heard of the Lord of the Rings at that time. I was too busy, like, always practicing music. And when I watched it, something, I think that was the final, like, push for me to go home and start writing. Actually, I think that same night I went home and attempted to write something like inspired by that, which was terrible. It came out terrible at the time. Because, you know, it's like, you're excited. I'm like, oh, I need to actually work on this to make it happen. But that, I think that was the impetus for me to do it. I needed like that final kick of inspiration and courage to pursue it, because it's something that I guess has been boiling over little by little since I was a kid. I mean, there were also moments when I was a kid where I watched like The Land Before Time and Indiana Jones. Obviously, all that stuff kind of it met at this apex point, which was in college. So.
Well, you know, as part of your work, this is kind of a no-brainer question, I guess, but I'll still ask it anyway. It, 'cause for those of us that don't compose for films, usually we're always seeing the end product with the music already laid into it. On rare occasions, and I've been, I don't know if you want to call it lucky, but there's been a couple of times, a couple of films I've seen where the score hasn't been done yet, and you see the movie without music. And it's amazing how dead almost the movie is.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of how to ask this question. So, in other words, because a lot of times what you're seeing is you're seeing the, you know, the finished cut, so to speak, but there's no music in it.
Exactly.
It must be dead. So, I mean, what's it like to try and bring that film to life with your talent and with your composing?
Exactly. No, I think your description is spot on. It's like, I would say, it's almost like colorless. It's missing this hue, this sheen, you know, about it. But it's a little frightening, actually, because, you know, the director and the producers are entrusting you to with their baby, basically, and you have to come up with something like from scratch, and that is frightening at first. But then, you know, then you start getting inspiration from either the characters, the story, the directors, the direction that they want, the vision. And just the camera shots. So, and then you start coming up with ideas and themes, and it builds from there. But at first, it's like very daunting, because they're like, you know, we want the music to do this, and sometimes they give you examples. They use temp music of what they want, just to kind of guide you, because sometimes obviously directors can't speak in musical terms, so they usually I usually ask them to speak in emotions, and that usually helps.
Yeah,
but, it is frightening at first when it's dead, like when it's completely blank. And
can you imagine? Because you're of an age, and you got started at a time where I'm assuming that temp tracks, if you will. I mean, you could use a computer and almost create an orchestral sound, whereas before, you know, your composers before you a lot of times would just like record something on a piano and expect the director to kind of understand what it's going to sound like at the end.
Yes.
I mean, do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I think John Williams is the only one to this day that can play something for a director on the piano and get away with it, because he's a legend. He deserves that honor, obviously, because his work has been fantastic, and it still is.
Well, and I'm sure my listeners are tired of hearing the story. You know the story about Spielberg sitting down with John Williams. He went over to his house and said, "Yeah, I've got the theme for Jaws." Do you know that story?
Oh, yes. He thought he was pulling his leg when he heard the first
time. Yeah,
right?
I mean, you know, he plays a dun-dun-dun-dun on the piano, and Spielberg goes, "That's it?" Yeah, that's it. But don't worry, it'll sound really great.
Exactly. Yeah. Those days are for people of my age, I guess, and younger. Yeah, we use a computer, and the thing is called, you know, we use a digital audio workstation, basically, and it's just like a computerized piano roll that can create all the, you know, you play in all the notes, and you have these sophisticated samples of live musicians, just pre-recorded samples,
yeah.
And you can basically shape it to sound like a real orchestral kind of finished product. And if you're if you're scoring modern films today, it's the layperson can't really tell, but sometimes there's a mix of these artificial or sampled instruments laid in on top of like the live musicians as well. It's just to give it a little bit more oomph.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, you have to create that for today's directors, and they've been trained. The directors expect that, so it's the only way to convey what you're going for in terms of the score that you want to write for them.
Yeah,
it's a good way to indicate it. So
another cue you chose is by another composer that I have great affinity for. I'm talking about Bill Conti, and it's the music from the score he wrote for Masters of the Universe. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your thinking on wanting to choose that to share today?
It's just something, again, it's one of those things, me being a kid and just like sharing that joy of listening to that music. And I used to watch a lot of He-Man when I was a kid.
Okay.
Especially the cartoons. And this is the 80s. And I think I begged my parents, can I please go? I was like, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9. Can I please go to the theater and watch this movie? And they said no, because we can't drive you. We're working. So I think I snuck out and watched it anyway with friends.
Ooh.
And yeah, I'm like, I have to watch it. And the music was just so fantastic. Oh my gosh. I mean, he created such a score that almost is up there with Star Wars and you know, Indiana Jones, and just the main theme is just, it just gets you going, makes you want to lift up a sword and start, you know, chopping down your enemies.
Yeah, so. And again, I think you're probably of the age. It's interesting too, is that because I'm old enough to know that music was so important, because you couldn't just go down to the video store and rent the movie or whatever, or stream it or whatever, and
right.
Hear the music again. The only way you could relive the movie was to buy the soundtrack album.
Yes.
And it brings back those visuals, doesn't it? And those emotions of a movie.
Exactly. And I remember specifically like the theme for Skeletor and his army. It sounded so much similar to like the Darth Vader march from Empire Strikes Back. But Bill Conti does, I've never heard an orchestra do that. As a kid, I was like, this is amazing. And plus the visuals of Skeletor, I was like, I'm sold. So this is, it's stuck, and it's a very compelling film up to this day. Even though, you know, Dolph Lundgren at the time was not the best actor.
That's okay. Yeah, well, let's have a listen for ourselves. This, again, is from the film Masters of the Universe, and it's written by composer Bill Conti.
Thank you.
I got to thinking as we were talking, because I don't know. Do you? I guess it's a couple of different questions here. Do you work with live orchestras versus just all computer generated stuff? And if you do work with a live orchestra, do you conduct or do you have someone else conduct for you? So that's kind of a couple of different questions there.
Yeah, great question. And I when I started, I come from, since I'm a violinist, I come from that orchestral world already. So
okay.
I think most of my scores, I try to have a live element. So I think my first film when I got to LA was a short film called, well, it was kind of like 45 minute film. It was called Odin Blood, and I got together a small chamber orchestra for that. And it was in Pasadena, the studio that is no longer there, unfortunately, but, I conducted that. And then later on, as you know, the budgets got a little bigger, for instance, in the reunion, it was during COVID we did this. So
okay.
I had to record it remotely over in Budapest. I was here in LA, and I would give notes to the conductor over the internet to relate to the musicians I needed, you know, for this to happen. And that was we had a larger, like a 40 piece orchestra or something. And then I think back in 2019, I also did The Sound of Identity, which we recorded here in LA at the United Recording, and I conducted that one. It was a 20 piece ensemble. So, and then for the newest one that I did, The Empire Queen, that one was actually, it was very strange because again, it was between COVID and then when things were opening up. So I had an ensemble, I had choir in Maine that I went and produced that. I had a friend of mine conduct that. And then I recorded strings and woodwinds in Budapest remotely.
Wow.
And then in LA, I had a brass session to finish off the score, and had another friend conduct that, because I think at that time the movie required so much score writing. I think I wrote at like 2.5 hours of music for that.
Holy smokes! Wow.
And I think by the time we got to the recording sessions, I think I was fried. I was like,
I bet.
Can someone else please conduct? Because I would be a zombie on the podium and not be able to hear things. And so yeah, but I love to conduct when you're rested and you can interact with the musicians and everything.
How do you feel about the? I'm going to try not to ask a leading question here as I say this. How sure. do you feel about the use of either live musicians versus computer-generated music?
I think both are valid and equally acceptable. I mean, I like, and this is just me as a personal preference, I sometimes try my best to include some sort of live element in all of my scores to give it that organic feel. But then what you can do with those live elements is that then you can manipulate them electronically, you know, because we have a lot of things called plugins, and you can, you know, kind of stretch the sounds or turn them upside down and do all these things to them. And but then it's funny because then I worked with other directors, for instance, who told me right at up front, I don't want anything live or organic. I need it to be all synthesizers. I was like, oh, that's great. Okay, great. So then I go into that little playground, and then I start experimenting and get to use those skills as well. So I think it's, you know, for me as a composer, I enjoy straddling both worlds. It's such a cool way to, you know, to write. And and being a composer nowadays for film, you need to kind of be able to, you know, wear a lot of hats.
What where do you think it's going? I mean, are we kind of going to the point where we won't have live musicians playing for scores anymore? I mean, is it going to go that far?
I don't think so. I mean, the orchestra has survived, you know, and it's still here. I think that is already embedded into our cultural identity as a society. So I think that will always be there. But I think it's going to be augmented by all these new things. Obviously, it's in the scores that we hear now, it's augmented by samples. And eventually, it's going to be, you know, AI is going to most likely play a role in that as well, in helping how do we compose. And not really, I don't see it necessarily taking over composition jobs, like replace composers, but I think it will aid in the creation of scores.
That was going to be my follow-up. I'm saying, so are you concerned about AI? But it sounds to me like perhaps you're not.
I don't think so. I mean, because each, like, for instance, I don't think AI could replace like a John Williams. I mean, it could probably imitate it, but because there's a large amount of data, right, that Williams has written over his career, or like a Jerry Goldsmith, or but after a while, it's just not going to, you can't, I guess, replace that humanity that Williams brings to it. I think it will affect, for instance, like music library music, like you hear in reality shows and stuff,
right,
like that. That could be easily churned out.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So in that regard, I think that might be a problem. But
okay.
Larger scale, I don't think so.
One of the other cues you wanted to play, and you've already mentioned, I think, this composer once. We're talking about James Horner for the score that he wrote for the film called Aliens. I'm trying to see here. I can't read my own writing. Was it the cue is called what? Queen? Goodness, I can't even read my own writing. What was it?
Queen to Bishop.
Yes. Queen to Bishop, that was the name of the cue, and you wanted to share that. So tell us a little bit about why that was among one of your favorites.
So I think when I was experimenting after listening to early 2000s, when I was getting into film scoring, I discovered the Aliens soundtrack. Like a little bit more in depth, I started listening to hardcore, and I remember this cue in particular, because it was this, if you've seen the movie, this is the sequence where the queen comes out of the ship and rips Bishop apart. It's very gruesome. Yeah. And he's an android, so he's not like, you know, he's still alive, sort of. But the music for this just picks up, and it's, you thought, okay, Ripley made it to the ship, it's safe, the queen is, you know, blew up in the, but now, you know, once he gets ripped, it's like this music comes in, and it really tears you apart as well in terms of like how it's written. There's a lot of aleatoric techniques, special effects. The strings are like ripping away, creating all these like sounds, and there's like an anvil. So all that like just made it super memorable for me. So it's particularly fond of it.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen for ourselves. Again, this is from the film called Aliens. The cue is called Queen to Bishop, and it's written by composer James Horner.
Thank you.
We'll get back to our program in a minute. This program is done for the love of film and film music, plain and simple. However, it does take a huge investment in time and in fees for me to make the program work for you. I don't sell commercial time and don't really want to on this program. Rather, I'm kind of like a public broadcasting station. I need support from listeners like you. For as little as $3 a month, you can help me offset the time spent in putting the program together. Or maybe you just think of it as leaving a tip in the tip jar. Either way, if you can join up, there will be bonuses, like an additional 10 to 15 minute segment with our guest every week. Well, we'll play additional cues as well as ask some extra questions. And it's going to be only available to patrons. How do you sign up? Well, it's simple. You go to patreon.com/whatsthescore, and that's all one word. That's Patreon, that's patreon.com/whatsthescore. Check it out. We'd be grateful for your support. That's patreon.com. So we've played several cues from a variety of different composers. I'm kind of curious, are there, two or three different composers that have ended up being a great influence on you and your work?
I mean, I think, and again, I tie this again to my childhood because I grew up with listening to their work. So maybe it has to be John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, and James Horner. Those are the ones that really influenced me growing up. Obviously, as I grew older and started researching some more, I love the works of Hans Zimmer and Christopher Young as well. And also composers from the classical and romantic eras like Mahler and Debussy and Varese as well because of the cool textures that he does. I mean, there's... it's just a wide variety, I would say. Debussy as well, Ravel. So I think I'm an amalgam of like all that, plus, and then a little bit of my Argentine kind of roots that I try and throw in there whenever I can. So I'm like a big mix.
Sounds like you're a mess, is what it sounds like.
I am. Like, make up your mind.
Again, my listeners may be bored by my asking this question, but one of the things that I find that seems to be lacking in film scores these days is quite frankly is melody. Mm-hmm. A lot of it just I hate to be critical, but a lot of it just sounds like noise. It's and I realize part of that is the fact that you're going to have, in some cases, like with action films in particular, you're going to compete with all the sound effects and all those sorts of things. But it just seems to me that melody is really missing. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Am I off base, or do you agree, or do you? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's funny because I remember James Horner, before he died, talked about this, and it was the time I think he was scoring Avatar. He mentioned that scores have shifted slightly in the 2000s to like more, sound design based or just more rhythmic in general, and melody took a back seat.
Okay.
I think because of it usually stems from either too many producers using temp music and the editors using temp music, and the studio wants to make sure everything sounds safe, or the director just. You know, grew up at a certain time and that's he or she likes that music. Usually it's never like the composer's intention to do that. It's like, you know, you're hired for a job and You want to fulfill a vision, and if that's what they want, you kind of have to do that.
Sure.
I'll give you an example. Like, when I worked on Empire Queen, for instance, this movie that I have going on now, we're promoting it. The director for that loved Melody. Like, he was a big proponent of Melody, loved the adventures of, like, Robin Hood, kind of like that swashbuckling feel. So we kind of we're listening to a bunch of, like, Eric von Wolfgang Korngold,
right,
and Alex North and stuff like this. So that's why the score to Empire Queen is super thematic and melodic and motif driven. So I think it really depends on the person who's leading the charge and especially who the director is. But again, if you have a, you know, like 20 producers telling the composer, well, we want it to sound like this, it's going to be kind of all over the place. And then I don't fault the composers at all, because it's a lot of forces kind of like shaping the music. But I tend to agree that it's gotten a little bit, I would say, away from Melody. And I hope it comes back. And I think it is.
That's got to be challenging for someone in your position, particularly because you're coming in at the, basically at the very end of the process, and you've got all these voices talking to you about, this is what we want, or please do this, or change that, or how challenging is that? And I mean, what have you done to try to learn how to adapt and learn how to deal with all these different voices that are giving you feedback? And does that make sense, what I'm asking? I don't know.
For sure. Yeah. No, it's, and you're spot on. It is, it does sound like that. You're in a room with sometimes, like, you know, 4, 5, 10 people, and they all have opinions, or you have to listen to all of them. But what worked for me is try to align myself with the person who has the ultimate decision. And I think usually that's either the director, if he has your back, or if she has your back, it's somebody that can, you know, is in your corner and can fight for your ideas. Or in other times I've had to, like, be in the corner of a producer, who sometimes the director and the producer are in conflict, and it happens a lot in certain films, especially in the indie world, especially if you have a very hands-on producer who thinks they're a director.
Ah, yes.
And then, like, you know, things can go haywire when that happens. But, you know, I try to align myself with either the director or somebody who can make the ultimate decision. I mean, I was on a film once where the director was ultimately fired and the producer was in charge. So I had to kind of, you know, listen to what they said and listen to their ideas. It's such an interesting business, and with a lot of opinions. But I think, you know, finding a strategy that works for you as a composer is kind of, you know, the best bet to kind of survive. It's, we call it being in the trenches.
Yeah.
At that point.
And it's not the kind of thing they teach you at music school, is it?
No, not at all. Yeah. This is like on the job learning, like real life experience. It's like, you know, in music school, everything's pretty and it's in a package and it's all in a controlled space. But in real life, you have opinions, you have people getting mad at you. Or the, you know, or some people are gracious and thank you, and, you know, but it's kind of like it runs the whole gamut, and
yeah.
It's very interesting. It keeps it fresh for me. That's
yeah. Sure. Well, you mentioned it, and it's worth bringing up. We've been playing other composers' works. Why don't we play one of yours? One of your recent projects is a film called Our New Queen, The Golden Age of Music, right? Or Magic, excuse me. The Golden Age of Magic.
Empire Queen, yeah.
Yeah, this is a pretty brand new film for you that you've worked on. Why don't you tell me a little bit about why you wanted to choose this particular cue today?
Yeah, so a little backstory about the film. I approached the director, Christine Owens, because I was scouring for kind of film to see what was available. There's a database I use called IMDb Pro, and I was just curious, you know, and I found this fantasy film. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. And again, you know, I'm thinking in my childhood, I'm like, this is a great opportunity to like write music in that style, and it's what I love. And I decided to call him up one day, and he's like, yeah, I need a composer. Why don't we just meet up for lunch? And anyway, we hit it off. And then I started sending him some demos, and eventually I got signed on to do the film. And this cue, this particular cue, kind of encompasses all the themes, pretty much the heroic themes of the film. There's Aura, who wields the magic, and then there's Jade Cross, who's like her protector, along with Sterling, the captain. Those are the trio of heroes. And this is a point in the film when she gets crowned queen, and she allows magic to be available to everybody. So it kind of sounds very heroic and bombastic and regal. And it ends at the end. It ends with a kiss. So it's very lovely.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to ourselves. We're going to listen to one of our guest compositions. Again, this is from the film Our New Queen, The Golden Age of Magic. And it's written by our guest here today, Nicholas Repetto. Prompted this question, which I hadn't planned on, which was interesting. It, and I realize you're kind of up and coming. You're somewhat established, I guess, but you know, still having to kind of establish your name and whatnot. Do you find yourself having to go after projects, and sell yourself, or do people approach you, or is it a mix of both?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, early on, I had to do a lot of that. And then as my name started going around within like director circles and stuff like this, like for instance, a few months ago, I got a film because of a director recommendation. So I think things are now you know, and it's been happening since last year. Things are starting to come to me by recommendation. So
oh,
I think
that's great.
I think if you're around long enough and you do great work and, you know, you're super professional and just a cool person to hang out with. I mean, I say that because in this industry, you have to not only, you know, work closely with the person, but it's nice to become friends, you know, and you do become friends and family with some of these people. So it's, I find that it's a mix of both, but, yeah, early on I had to, and like, again, it goes back to my father and being a go-getter, and he's always instilled that in me. And I still do that because I just, you know, waiting around for somebody to give me some work is not usually what I like to do. So I'm always, like, researching and seeing what I can do, and I'm taking the initiative. So that's what I like.
Yeah, I guess, once again, they don't teach you this in music or film school, and that is that in your line of work, I'm assuming that things like networking and establishing relationships and reputations and those sorts of things are a huge part of your success. Would that be safe to say? Yeah.
I would say it's vital to anyone's success in this. I think it's, you have to, and especially in living in LA, there's so many like film festivals, you know, seminars. For instance, I'll give you an example. I wanted to meet action directors. So I went to a fight choreography like class.
Yeah.
To meet, and there were, it was filled with action directors, and I got to know many of them, and I was like the only composer there. So
perfect. Good planning on your part. All right.
And it's just, you know, I'm like, you have to think outside the box of where to meet people and get to know them. And it's a great way, especially living in LA or any major entertainment hub. It's, you have to get out there and explore and not be shy. And again, it's, you know, most composers, we tend to like stay in our studios, closed off from the world, in our little caves, writing music. But we also have to interact. You know, it's important. It's a very important part of the business, and being social, just, you know, sharing in our humanity and our love for life.
Yeah, one of the things I like about the list of cues that you provided today that you wanted to play is that in several cases these are composers that we don't. We don't play a lot. They just aren't, you know, on our guests' lists of favorites. One that you wanted to play was written by composer Elliot Goldenthal.
Yes.
The film is Interview with a Vampire. The cue is called Escape to Paris. Tell me a little bit about why you wanted to play that particular cue today.
Yeah, so I remember watching that film when I was in high school, and I was going through this period of my life where, you know, I really identified with these characters because I was in high school. I played the violin. One of the characters in the Interview with the Vampire novels, his name is Nicholas, like me, and he played violin. And he was like a love interest of Louis and stuff like this. So all that romanticism and like homoeroticism of the whole thing was like, my gosh, that's like what I do, what I'm doing, what's happening to me now. And because I was like 15, you know, going through teenage years and going through, you know, changes and stuff like this. So I really identified with those characters, especially Louis and Lestat. And I thought Elliot Goldenthal just captured the essence of just the novel and just the breadth of like the storytelling. So this is why it goes back to my teenage years, and I love it.
Okay, oh, terrific. Let's have a listen for ourselves. Again, this is from the film Interview with a Vampire. The cue is called Escape to Paris, and it's written by composer Elliot Goldenthal.
Thank you.
So anything in the pipeline, anything looking to the future that you've that you can share with us that you've got going on or any current projects that we can look forward to?
Yes, I'm I got this project a few months ago. It's it's a thriller, kind of like supernatural thriller called Ghost Train, and it's by a new director, new to me, that was recommended by another friend. And yeah, the movie just looks fantastic, and it's has some crazy special effects in it, and hopefully I will be starting work on that in probably the next few months. So excited about that. It's gonna have a kind of like dark romantic orchestral score.
And, okay.
I think we're gonna head in that direction. We'll see, but we have to sit down and discuss it. But the movie looks fantastic.
And, yeah, and how do people stay in touch with you and know what you've got going on? I'm assuming you have like a social media presence. Share that with us.
Yes, I'm on Facebook. Just if you type Nicholas Repetto, I'm there. I'm on Instagram, Repetto Music, and it's my last name with M-U-Z-I-K. And
okay.
That's like my social media handle everywhere. And then I have a website, you know, nicholasrepetto.com. And you can type in Nicholas Repetto Composer on Google, and I pop up.
Okay, so, terrific.
Yeah.
Nicholas, look, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you. I can tell you have a real passion for it, and I can also tell I think you're going to be very successful as the years go on, and I look forward to following your career and your future projects. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as I have.
It was fantastic. I really appreciate it, Frank, and I love just the podcast and the guests that you've had as well, other composers. I've really enjoyed their conversations as well. So.
Oh, thank you. Believe me, I mean, I think as I told you before we started recording, I'm not a musician. I don't know.
Right.
I know very little about music, but I know what I like. And I just, film music has been a huge part of my life, and it's been a, I don't want to over-dramatize it, but it truly has been a dream come true to talk with some of these people that produce this magic, people like yourself that give me great joy and move me a great deal. So believe me, it's my pleasure. My thanks again to Nicholas Repetto for joining us today on the program. Please do follow him and check out what he's got going on. I want to thank all our listeners for listening to the program, and especially those of you that are patrons on patreon.com. Thank you again for your support of the program. And there's not much else to say other than this, that my name's Frank R. Wilson. My time's up. I thank you for yours. Thanks for listening to What's the Score?